Hello and welcome to the Mothball Prophecies. I am your host, Jonathan. Tonight we are taking a trip out of Louisiana to Rawlins, Wyoming. And why, do you ask? I'll tell you in a second. But first, I want to thank those of you who sent emails about the Saint Germain episode. Both the supportive ones and the ones who pointed out some particulars about theosophy that I got incorrect. All feedback is appreciated, and while I love the positive stuff, I also welcome the comments that allow me to learn. So, thank you. Now, back to Wyoming. When you think of Wyoming, what comes to mind? Old Faithful and the Grand Prismatic Spring? Definitely. I've been to see both, and the sulfur springs in that park are beautiful. But they also have these absolutely horrific signs from what looks like the 1960s that shows the drawing of a kid getting scalded to death. You know, one of those stay out of here warning signs. They're absolutely ghastly. I'll see if I can find a picture of one and I'll post it to the Facebook page. As another aside, as you're walking through the park, where there are spots with bubbling hot mud, you'll occasionally see a baseball cap just resting on the mud, which makes you wonder what's under the hat. Or, you know, maybe thoughts like that just occur to me. But anyway, when I went to Wyoming, there was one thing on my mind: getting to Devil's Tower. I drove out there in the mid-90s, so X-Files was everywhere, and there was another resurgence of sightings. Hell, there was even a show by that title, as kind of a spiritual successor to In Search Of. But my head was always stuck in the 1970s and 80s, with the second wave of contactees in the U.S., only this wave was nothing like the Space Brothers, like Valiant Thor and the aliens that George Adamski and his little circle claimed to have encountered. This round of experiences in the 70s involved something closer to what Betty and Barney Hill experienced back in the 60s. Now, I know I recently did a show on Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker in Mississippi in 1973, and during that episode, I gave an abbreviated list of abduction stories that took place in the 70s. And if you want to learn more about that, go back and listen to the Pascagoula episodes. For now, we're in Wyoming, during October of 1974. Let me set the stage for you. Wyoming is, or was, home to a number of oil drilling sites in the 60s and 70s. However, the U.S. hit peak oil in the late 60s, which led to an economic shit show in the 1970s. We had inflation, stagnation, recession, and high unemployment. Plus, building tensions with the Middle East over oil production and imports. But, Jonathan, you ask, what in the devil's black hell does this have to do with alien abduction? Well, this is where we meet the star of our episode, Carl Higdon. Carl was a foreman on an oil drilling rig in Rawlins, Wyoming. He was hardworking by all accounts, had a family of seven, and even earned the nickname the Wyoming Coyote because of his determination. In late October, Carl was getting ready for a long day of work. He was heading out to pick up his crew when he received a call from the project manager that a good number of his crew were sick with a flu. So there was no point in Carl showing up to be the foreman on an empty rig. Now let's just pause and think about that for a second. I tried to keep these shows evergreen, But this is one thing that really struck me in a time when people are pushing for businesses to reopen during a pandemic, and when workers are being caught between working in conditions where they might catch the novel coronavirus, or staying home and getting fired so they can't get unemployment benefits. In the 1970s, during a horrible recession, when we were pushing domestic oil in spite of everything, people on an oil rig got sick and stayed home, and the manager called to tell Carl Higdon to also stay home, and no one lost their jobs. Because that basic human consideration for health was still there, even if it was far from perfect. But I digress. So, with Carl getting the green light to stay home, he took the opportunity to take his gun and pack up the truck to go elk hunting. After all, no work meant no pay, but an elk could provide meat for his whole family for quite some time. On his way to his destination, Carl Higdon came across some other hunters on the side of the road. Apparently, their truck stopped running, so Carl stopped and offered to help. They shot the breeze for a bit, and the hunters told him of a different location out in the woods as opposed to Carl's usual spot in the canyon. So Carl decided to follow this hot tip, and maybe he'd be able to get some elk. Carl Higdon went deep into the woods until he found a clearing. And out in the clearing, he saw 5 elk. Don't feel disappointed that I didn't say aliens, because the story is about to get very weird. Carl set up on the edge of the clearing and lined up his shot with the elk. He pulled the trigger and something was wrong. But let's hear it in Carl's own words.
I went to pick up my crew to go to work, and one of them was sick, so we couldn't work. So I came back to the house and decided I'd go hunting. So I decided to go on down into the forest, and I hunted down there until, oh, it must have been around 4 o'clock. So I walked down over this hill. Whenever I got over the hill, I seen these 5 elk standing down there. One of them was a big bull, so I raised my gun to shoot.
But, unlike that audio clip, there was no noise. The bullet traveled out of the barrel of the rifle as if in slow motion. It went in a straight line for only a few feet, and then stopped in mid-air and dropped to the ground. And despite this strange turn of events, Carl walked over to the spot where the bullet dropped, picked it up, and put it in his pocket. Because, apparently, the bullet that had just been fired wasn't hot. Which is kind of strange. Then Carl turned around and saw a man. But this man was different from any man he'd ever seen. This man was about 6 feet tall, bow-legged, and had straw-colored hair that stood straight up. The man's skin was yellowish, and he was dressed all in black, almost like a neoprene diving suit. The other thing Carl noticed was that the man didn't really have hands. One was completely missing, like his arm came down, and then at the wrist there was nothing. And the other hand kind of came to a point, but the point was translucent and seemed to completely vanish when the man moved his arm, kind of like when you drop a diamond into water. The man asked Carl if he was hungry, to which Carl replied, "Yeah, a little." Suddenly, a packet of pills floated from the man to Carl. The stranger told Carl to eat one, and Carl complied, not because this was the 1970s and we as a society didn't know any better, but because Carl felt compelled to, which is weird, because according to Carl's wife Marjorie, Carl hated taking pills of any sort, even aspirin. So after Carl took the pill, the man asked Carl to follow him, to which Carl said, might as well, because that is the most 1970s setup for a low-budget film I've ever read. The next thing Carl knew, he was inside some sort of cubicle, or a cage made of glass, but with no bars. He was strapped into a chair and couldn't turn his head. However, he said he could sense the elk behind him. That's right, the alien didn't just abduct Carl, he abducted the elk as well. Because you can't leave any witnesses. Then Carl found himself looking down through some sort of window or portal. He saw his pickup truck on the ground. Then the pickup disappeared. Then he saw a blue ball that looked kind of like a marble. Then everything went black. Then there was bright light. So bright that Carl could barely keep his eyes open. Suddenly, there were two aliens, and they took Carl down a long walkway. Only they didn't walk. They floated. And so did Carl. Now, we're going to pause here. It's easy to say this seems very reminiscent of Charles Hickson's experience in Pascagoula when he was floated aboard an alien craft by two beings. And this specific part of the encounter does raise some questions. Charlie Hickson's abduction took place in 1973 and received international attention. Carl Higdon's encounter, the one we're covering right now, happened almost a full year later. As a matter of fact, it happened around the same time Charles Hickson was having his second encounter. So, is this a knockoff story? For now, this is the only similarity I can come across between the two cases. And remember, Charles Hickson, Carl Higdon, Travis Walton, Betty and Barney Hill, this is where we start to see the lore take shape for the archetypical alien encounter that's become the go-to in everyday society and a very, very serious topic among the more fringe pockets of the world. So the aliens floated Carl down the long corridor, and Carl thinks he's getting prepped for some sort of examination. Except the aliens say, "You're not what we want." Then all of the aliens disappeared except for the one Carl met in the woods. The alien finally introduced himself as Auzo One. That's AUZZOONE. O-N-E, as in the number. Auzo One. Auzo One tells Carl, "We have been coming to Earth for many years. We come in search of fish and animals. Our food is in the form of pills. One pill will last for 3 days. We make the pills from fish and animals. Our ocean is yellow. All the fish have died." Which is a really fucking weird way to introduce yourself. "Hi. We don't want anything to do with you, but here's a little background on those pills we gave you." It's just awkward. Then Auzo One told Carl that they were currently 163,000 light miles from Earth, and that the nine planets of our solar system supply the aliens with the magnetic force for power that they need. Let's pause again, because there's a bit to unpack here. Let's try and wrap our heads around what the hell a light mile is. A light year is the distance light can travel in the span of 1 year. Light travels at roughly, and to use English measurement, because that is what the aliens were using, 186,000 miles per second. That's the speed of light. So, in 1 year, light travels a distance of, again, roughly 5.9 trillion miles. Thanks, Google. There's a reason I decided against doing a math podcast. But we're talking light miles here, not light years. So we have to blow things apart and do some weird reverse math. Light travels a single mile in roughly 5.3 microseconds. So, that's one light mile, because the distance is measured in time, and I swear the first person to mention parsecs in the comments will be penalized one bottle of whiskey. I will give you the address personally. So, AUSA-1 said they were 163,000 light miles from Earth, which is, let's see, 5.3 times, yep, put the 4 there and carry the chicken, divide by Reddit, and, aha, 863,900 microseconds, or 0.86 seconds, which translates to 159,000 miles. So, not quite a full light year. In fact, Carl and the aliens would be right next to nothing. They'd be in the middle of space. The void. Not quite far from Earth at all in the cosmic sense of things. But golly gee, 163,000 light miles sure does sound impressive. Sorry for the math bomb, everyone, and my calculations were probably way off. If you can figure this out, send an email to mothball@crescentcitymedia.com. So, after the math lesson, the alien took Carl's rifle, looked at it, and said he wanted to keep it. But it's a primitive weapon, and he's not allowed to keep weapons. Or he's not allowed to take things from the specimens he abducts. I couldn't quite figure out which. He also told Carl that the reason he wore a black suit was because the sun burned him. Now, why the alien wasn't wearing anything to protect his head is beyond me. The spaceship then came back down to Earth and hovered above the ground. AUSA-1 said he would see Carl again. And then Carl Higdon was just floated down to the ground. And this is kind of screwed up. The aliens abduct Carl. They say, hey, you're not what we wanted, but hey, we're going to see you again. This is just a really weird passive-aggressive relationship they're establishing. I don't like it. It's like dealing with a pickup artist or something. So, Carl landed. And as he did, he slipped on a rock and hurt his shoulder. Carl was disoriented and lost in the woods. He didn't know who he was. He found a truck, but didn't recognize the stick shift, which was very weird because Carl drove a standard transmission. He'd been driving standard since he was a kid. He sat in the truck and heard voices coming through the CB radio. Did I mention this took place in the 1970s? The voice kept asking Carl who he was, but he couldn't remember. The voice asked him to look in the glove compartment in the truck and read the papers inside. Carl couldn't read them. He didn't know who he was. He was feeling very cold and wanted to know where the hell his elk were. Meanwhile, back in town, Carl Higdon's wife Marjorie had just come home from work. It was about 4 p.m., and since this was late October in Wyoming, it was pretty dark. Marjorie had a funny feeling that something was wrong, and she wanted to go look for Carl. Obviously, if Carl shot elk that day, it would have taken him some time to field dress the animal and haul it back to his truck. But she still had that nagging feeling that something was wrong. At around 6:30 that evening, the phone rang. Someone from Carl's oil company was on the other end of the line. They said they knew Carl went hunting that day, and they needed to know where he went. They said they got a weird message from someone on the company's CB radio line, and they sounded hurt. A search party was assembled, and the sheriff's department went out looking for Carl. Marjorie called her friend Marilyn to have her and her husband take Marjorie out to help look for Carl, because the Higdons only had one vehicle, and Carl took it that morning to go hunting. Eventually, the search party found the truck with Carl inside. The first words he uttered to his wife, Marjorie, were, "They took my elk." Carl seemed dazed, and when Marjorie tried to put her coat over him for warmth, Carl freaked out, yelling, "Don't touch me! Don't touch me!" They eventually got Carl into their vehicle and drove off. They stopped to meet the sheriff a bit up the road, and suddenly Carl bolted from the vehicle, once again screaming, "The lights! The lights! Oh God, the lights!" Once Carl calmed down a bit, he asked the sheriff, who happened to be wearing black, "Doesn't the sun burn you?" Then Carl told Marjorie and the sheriff about his 163,000-light-mile trip into outer space. They took Carl to the hospital, and not just because he hurt himself in the woods. At the Carbon County Hospital, Carl was a bit out of sorts, to put it mildly. He was an absolute wreck would be a more accurate, though non-medical, diagnosis. His shoulder was injured. He couldn't remember where he was. He kept asking for those three-day pills that, quote, "just float to you." And he was going on about his 163,000-light-mile journey. He also had outbursts about the lights and how they were bright and burned him. Interestingly, his blood test came back negative for any types of drugs, and the official diagnosis for his mental state in 1974 was amnesiac shock. While he was in the hospital, Carl drew a picture of the being he met in the woods. Eventually, Carl regained his bearings, and the hospital treated his shoulder. He went home with his wife, and a piece of metal fell out of his canteen pouch as Marjorie Higdon was putting away Carl's hunting gear. She and Carl looked at it and realized it was a bullet casing, but it looked like it had been turned inside out. She took it to the sheriff's office and asked the deputy how a casing could have been turned inside out, and the response the deputy gave her was, "Don't question it. Just leave it alone." Now, I want to dive down the rabbit hole and say, yes, the sheriff's department was in on the cover-up of this abduction, but you know what? That little line of thinking goes nowhere. That was just a statement from the deputy. It doesn't get followed up on in any way whatsoever in any retellings of this story. Within a day after returning home, as these things tend to happen in small towns with not much going on, Carl found himself on the front page of the local newspaper. This eventually garnered the attention of Dr. R. Leo Sprinkle, or R. L. Sprinkle, or Leo Sprinkle. It really depends on which source you're reading or watching. Now, Dr. Sprinkle is a psychologist who happened to work with people who had experiences with UFOs and extraterrestrials. In addition to being a very polite person by all accounts, Dr. Sprinkle was also a consultant on the Condon Report in 1969, a report that emphatically stated that UFOs are not a threat. The ultimate conclusion of the Condon Report was that UFOs, as objects from an extraterrestrial origin, do not exist. If you see a UFO, it may very well be unidentified to you. But, with further examination, other experts could probably tell you what the UFO was. An aircraft, a weather balloon, swamp gas, something. That's pretty much the short version of the Condon Report. But just because Dr. Sprinkle worked on the Condon Report doesn't mean he was a debunker in the same way that, say, Philip Klass was a hardline UFO debunker. Quite the contrary. Dr. Sprinkle was sympathetic to contactees, often using hypnotic regression to get at what they perceive to be the truth. And yes, I am less than credulous when it comes to the topic of hypnotic regression. I think it opens up opportunities to lead or mislead the patient. And ultimately, I think it gets into dicier territory because fact and perceived truth can get blurred. And while no one wants to tell a scared or confused person that their reality is a bit off, can you deny that perceived reality when it's consistent every single time the person goes under? The following is Dr. Sprinkle's assessment of Carl Higdon. My impression of Carl Higdon is that he is a man of integrity, with an average education, but a keen sense of curiosity about the world around him. He is an outdoorsman, and seems to have developed good skills of estimating size and distance. Although the sighting of a single UFO witness often is difficult to evaluate, the indirect evidence supports the tentative conclusion that Carl Higdon is reporting sincerely the events which he experienced. Hopefully, further statements from other persons can be obtained to support the basic statement. Unquote. Shortly after the sessions with Dr. Sprinkle, the In Search of team showed up. And for those of us in a certain demographic, In Search of was probably the gateway to a wide range of paranormal topics. For those who have never seen a single episode of the series hosted by Leonard Nimoy, look it up on YouTube. You will have a blast and you will see how In Search of laid the groundwork for modern shows on the History Channel and Destination Discovery. Anyway, they decided to dedicate a portion of one of their episodes to Carl Higdon's experience. Because this was the 1970s and television budgets were relatively sparse, In Search of had a knack for doing dramatic reenactments with the very people who had the experiences. So, in this episode, we get Carl Higdon reliving his hunting and abduction experience, which, if it happened, is a really careless thing to do to a person. So, without further ado, let's hear Carl Higdon reliving his alien encounter from the second he fired the bullet.
Fire. The bullet don't look right. There's somebody. Strange. He wants me to go with him. Lights are bright. Open. Can't see. They look like me. Same features. He said the sun burns him. He's gonna take me back.
Let yourself go back inside the cubicle. What happens inside the cubicle?
Oh. I can't get in. There ain't no door.
You know how you get in?
No. We're above the trees. I can see pretty good. The ball looks like a basketball, but it's got a blue gray outline. It's kind of dark, no lights. There's the light again. We're back.
So after the hypnosis sessions, Carl underwent psychiatric testing, which uncovered no mental illness. He took polygraph tests and passed them with flying colors. This went on for months and months. A little while later, Carl, Marjorie, and their son Mike went for a nighttime drive. Carl seemed to know exactly where he was going and went off the main road to drive along a dirt trail and up a hill. Once they reached the top of the hill, everyone in the car suddenly saw a green light in the sky that was shaped like an upside-down ice cream cone. Now, if you remember from Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was not even in production in 1974, one of the prominent UFOs is referred to as the ice cream cone by a number of characters in the film. Anyway, back to Carl and his family. Everyone in the truck saw the light. They saw the upside-down ice cream cone. And suddenly they started to notice a horrible smell, like an intense sulfur. These smells are also common when you look up abduction experiences, encounters with the fae folk, and, of course, demons. I can guarantee you that Nick Redfern, who is a prolific writer on these topics, has touched on the odors associated with high strangeness in at least two of his books. The green ice cream cone-shaped light disappeared, and Carl shut the motor off in the truck and said, "I'm late. I was supposed to be here a few minutes earlier." Why am I here? If we had been here on time, what would have happened to us? After that, and probably a long period of awkward silence, Carl drove his family home. A few nights later, Carl woke up his wife Marjorie in the middle of the night to tell her that they, quote-unquote they, were speaking with him. He told Marjorie that they were taking wild game and to look for a black box. Carl was scared because he thought the aliens were letting him know that they could contact him whenever they wanted. Now, other people in town were also starting to report strange lights, as these things tend to happen once someone reports a UFO sighting. But whether Carl was a hero for stepping forward with his story, or just the match that set off a powder keg of UFO hysteria in a small town, is not a judgment call I'm going to make on this show. Carl went out to the spot where he was abducted and took photos of the trees where, you know, where the craft supposedly was standing in the clearing. And the leaves around that area still looked singed. He also took photos of strange carvings he found on the trees in that area, but could never figure out if they meant anything. People supposedly had strange experiences in that forest going back ages, though I'll be damned if I could find any of the tales when I was researching this episode. So what are we left with? Well, we can take these things at face value. Carl Higdon had a very unusual experience. Unfortunately, most of his experiences were without witnesses, or when there were witnesses, he was hearing voices in his head, and it's really hard to prove that to other people. Someone, like Philip Klass, on the other hand, might have said that Carl took drugs that morning. Maybe when he was shooting the breeze with the hunters who had the broken-down truck and just had a wild trip, and by the time he was brought to the hospital, the drugs had passed through his system. In fact, I'd go so far as to say the debunkers would claim that Carl knowingly knocked off of work to go do drugs alone and escape the pressures of the bad economy, a ruthless job, and trying to provide for a large family. But that also doesn't quite make sense. Carl was hardworking and needed every hour on his job to earn money, especially during a horrible, horrible recession. He also knew how important bagging an elk would be as far as providing food for his family went. He wasn't the type to just fuck off in the woods. The bullet that turned itself inside out and dropped to the ground, the bullet wasn't on drugs, and that is a tangible thing that Carl put in his pocket, that Marjorie found, that still exists to this day. There are pictures of it. I will put that on the Facebook after I upload this episode. There was also the ice cream cone light that was seen by multiple witnesses. Marjorie, who was not prone to telling tall tales, Carl's son, who pretty much has stayed out of the limelight. It's not like Carl's son Mike has tried to get books published or go on late night radio shows that I could find anyway. Another interesting thing. Before the experience, Carl Higdon had been passing a lot of kidney stones, and he also had scars on his lungs. After the encounter with Ozo 1, the kidney stones stopped and the scars went away. though that was not mentioned in the medical report from when Carl was taken to the hospital. Also, the little black box that the aliens mentioned when they were speaking to Carl in his head, that's also a dead end. No one found a little black box. And I actually haven't heard of continued communications with Carl. Because, yes, Carl Higdon and Marjorie Higdon are still alive, and they still talk about the incident when they're asked. Marjorie Higdon even published a book on the experience. Dr. Leo Sprinkle is still around, and occasionally does interviews and has amassed a mountain of data on people who have experienced high strangeness. But perhaps the best thing that came out of this was Carl Higdon's opinion about mental health and realizing that it's okay to seek professional help.
Don't make a hill of beans to me what anybody believes or not. I know what happened to me. If people want to take it at face value, that's fine. If they don't, it don't make any difference. The only thing I'm saying is if this does happen to anybody else, what they are to do is talk to somebody about it. Not to hold it inside and try to conquer it themselves, because it can't be done, I don't think. I don't think our mind can take it. As far as the experience happening to me, I think if it hadn't been for Dr. Sprinkle, I probably would have been in the institution by now.
And that's the story about Carl Higdon. As always, thank you all for listening. If you liked the episode, or if you liked any of the other episodes, please share them with your friends and join our Facebook page. If you've had a strange experience you'd like to share, or you know someone who's had a strange experience, you can post it on the Facebook page, or share it with our Facebook group, or send it in an email to mothball@crescentcitymedia.com. Next time, we are going back to Louisiana for more high strangeness. Until then, sleep tight.